Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. All right, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast. I'm excited today to be joined by my neighbor to the south, Phil Borgeli, writer, author, bird hunter, all bunch of things, right, Phil?
That's three. I think three things is about this. That's about all I do.
What have you been up to lately? Obviously, winter has arrived for you and I, which we've discussed a little bit, and maybe we'll get into that. But what have you been up to lately?
Winter arrived, and with it came a whole lot of geese. I've been waterfowling the last couple times out where I've been goose hunts, and it's gone really well. Yesterday was the last day of duck season, and we hunted a field, and we turned out to be more of a goose hunt with ducks on the side, but it was great. And we shot a bunch of geese and saw a bunch of ducks and shot a few of them, and it was a really nice way to end the season.
What was the conditions like yesterday? It was kind of, we're in a little bit of a warm-up right now.
Yesterday was pretty nice. You know, I still get cold because you're sitting still not doing anything, but it was pretty balmy compared to other field hunts I've been on later in the season. And we had rain overnight, which is odd, but rain and high winds overnight, and now we're having just high winds. So some of our snow melted, which is great. It'll make room for the snow that's coming this weekend from what I've been tomorrow, I think.
I don't know. We got a little bit of snow early this week, and I was listening to the forecast after I dropped my boys off at school this morning, and they were saying something like, there's a system coming into the area, but it sounded like it was going to go to the south of me, so maybe smack dab in the middle for you.
I think it's going to be, there's actually quite a bit of room between us. I've driven up there. So it may pass harmlessly in between. I'm hoping so, because as we were discussing, while snow is great for your grouse, it's not really good for my pheasants, and it's really bad for the quail. And so I would just assume we lost it all. That doesn't seem to be the plan this year.
I was holding out hope for that, because the last few years, we've gotten kind of spoiled, I would say. As a Northwoods grouse hunter, we've had these very, you know, a couple of years ago, I mean, it was almost embarrassing to call it a winter. We didn't really have a winter. So we've been snow-free in certain areas so late into the season that, again, I've just been spoiled with those kind of hunting conditions. And this year, that did not happen. It's been hard to, like, kind of wrap my head around just the stark contrast. November was so mild. We had just this really nice stretch of weather for bird hunting. Snow freaking, I mean, we didn't have like a hint of snow until right before Thanksgiving. We got that snowfall, and then we dipped below freezing, and we have not been above it since, which, again, as we were chatting before we hit record, is good for the grouse because the snow conditions are really, really nice. It's just light, powdery, fluffy. And we've got some really cold temps coming this weekend. You know, regionally, people will experience that, I'm sure. And that's going to be good for the grouse. The grouse that are out, they're probably not getting pestered nearly as much as they have been the last few years. And they've got insulative snow out there. So not a bad thing. But yeah, I know that's different for pheasants and quail, that's for sure.
As we also discussed earlier, some of these invasive species of all different kinds that are creeping north need to see what a good Midwestern winter is like so they can rethink whether they really want to move up here or not.
Yeah, I heard you mention armadillos. What else?
Yes, I said a friend of mine sent me a picture of an armadillo, and well, that's armadillos are enough. They're not wild hogs, but they're pretty bad on nests. This was in southern Iowa, so 2-3 hours south of me, but he caught an armadillo on his trail camera, which is the first I've seen in Iowa.
So you're northern Iowa?
Central.
Central, okay.
We're just right in the middle. We're right on Interstate 80 here, so which cuts halfway through the state.
I know you very much enjoy chasing pheasants in your home covers and other places, and that was definitely one of the inspirations for me to reach out and connect with you, just knowing the time of year and that sort of thing. What has the pheasant season been like this year? And maybe preview, what was it supposed to be? And then what have you experienced thus far?
It is supposed to be the best. This is our 100th year of pheasant hunting in Iowa.
I think I read something about that.
And it is supposed to be the best season in 20 years, my best season in 20 years. But due to, I haven't hunted quite as much as usual and have been picky about when I pull the trigger and some other stuff. So I'm not having a huge year. But I have been, well, just Friday, I was to place south of me and saw birds in 1990s numbers, which I have not seen in a while. And I made a trip earlier this season over to hunt with an English setter breeder whom I met at Pheasant Fest in Western Iowa. We saw birds like I had not seen in many years. So they are there. In a lot of cases, they are either on public areas or on private areas that are managed in various CRP practices that benefit pheasants. It's less and less the case that farms have both corn and pheasants, or so, you know, crops and pheasants, more the case that they've got one or the other. And there's a lot more corn than pheasants. So I think it's going to be good. We're just past the halfway mark of our season. So I've still got 31 days to hunt, and we'll be going a lot. You know, ducks just closed. That's out of my system now. And I will be going a lot. And I think, you know, usually the second half of the season is the better part for me anyway. So it's very warm early on. I don't really like to hunt in warm weather. It's hard on the dogs. It's hard. It's not that much fun. So I will be trying to get out quite a bit in the latter half. And I think we'll probably do pretty well.
That's kind of what I was envisioning. You know, when I say it was, you know, we had a really ideal November, you know, kind of very mild. I imagine that it was probably warmer than you would like to really get out there. And when you're working dogs and hiking vigorously and that sort of thing.
Yeah. As a lot of time too, what I like to try to do is get work done in the morning, which is my best writing time.
Yeah.
And then hunt in the afternoon. And when it's getting to be into the 60s in the afternoons, I usually find something else to do or I'll hunt, you know, some mornings, but not as much as I'll usually hunt. So that cut into my hunting time some. Certainly my retired friend that I hunt with, who can go out whenever he wants, has been having quite a good year. So right around here. So so I think, you know, it varies. It's not all. There's various factors are contributing to me not having quite the year I'd imagine. But last year was great for me, and there's only so many birds I need to shoot.
What kind of fluctuations do you see in, you know, I know pheasant forecasts are kind of a big deal. And I just know, just sort of as like a casual bystander, like I've heard about the boom years. And like you mentioned, the 1990 numbers, obviously I wasn't chasing pheasants back then, but what's a typical year to year fluctuation, and what are the factors that you're aware of that kind of influence that?
Well, our small game biologist in Iowa's got it quantified pretty well. He has a formula that takes into account consecutive days with snow on the ground. And that has proven for him to be very accurate over the years. Our formal survey is a roadside count that is conducted by DNR personnel and others in August. And that is pretty accurate, but also depends on it being dewy enough that pheasants are getting out on the roads in the mornings when they run these routes to be drying off. So if it's a dry August, you know, your counts can be misleading. Honestly, it seems pretty consistent year to year. It is more about how much habitat there is. So, you know, while we're having a good year this year, there's fewer places where there are pheasants, is what it is. It's not so where there's good habitat for pheasants, you got pheasants, and where there isn't, you don't. And the kind of places where I like to hunt the most, which are cornfields with brushy draws and grassy filter strips and that type of thing, those are harder and harder to find. And you go either find, you can find a field that's all CRP, or you can find a field that's all corn, but ones that are in between are a little harder to find, at least in my part of the state.
Classic mixed diverse habitat, what you're looking for.
It's what I like, and it's what's harder to find and what we need a lot more of. Unfortunately, agriculture is going in a different direction right now.
What does the makeup of, do you tend to hunt? Now, I don't think Iowa is known for having a ton of public land, but they definitely have public land. Do you hunt mostly public? Do you have private access? How does that shake out for you?
I have not shot a public pheasant in quite a while, not because I don't want to, but I got a lot of places to go. Between myself and the guy that I hunt with quite a bit, we have enough places to go that we have pretty good private land access. Is not, unless you're deer hunting in Iowa, is not that hard to come by. Finding landowners can be really hard, because so many of the farms, as the farms get bigger and people live off the farm, the part where you could just go around to the back and find someone feeding hogs and get permission to hunt, that doesn't happen so much anymore. It takes a little work to find landowners. But if you can, you know, especially around here where we just have so many fewer bird hunters than we used to. When our birds crashed, you know, between 08 and 14, we had a bunch of bad winters and price of corn went way up and a lot of people came out of CRP and started plowing up marginal land. It's just been hard to find. And the farms have started getting bigger then. And we lost a whole generation, a whole culture of pheasant hunting back then. It used to be we had a lot more pheasant hunters than we do now. And the ones we have now are mostly public land hunters, it seems like, at least in this area. So, and that's one of the reasons I don't, you know, I have private land, is I know some people and I know I can beat crowds. I always like hunting public land. I was always like the challenge of it. I like knowing that it's like my land, but I don't do a whole lot of it anymore.
Quite a bit different than the way I'm approaching it up here, just because of the abundance of public land and also the way that ruffed grouse habitat tends to lay out and how that is synergistic with public lands. And
yeah, that's what I love about where you live. You know, you can hunt anywhere.
Yeah.
It's not even a question about, no, can you hunt there? That is such a great feeling of freedom.
Yeah.
Which is a part of the appeal of hunting that, but you know, my trips to northern Minnesota, it's a magical place. You can, and I, of course, I don't see it except in like October, but when it's at its most magical. But yeah, the idea that you can just hunt anywhere is well, not anywhere, but almost so many places, so many thousands of acres, hundreds of thousands of acres of land in any county you go to is just so much different than what I know.
You could safely say that it's almost a, you know, kind of a limitless feeling as far as, you know, there's as many places to hunt as I could ever hunt, and that feeling is very freeing, as you aptly stated. Yep. But I could certainly see, you know, it in your situation, if you have good private land access and you're looking at one versus the other, you know, you can go and hunt a piece of private ground, and that's the way that works in that area, which is good.
And I'm also very lucky to live. I live in a place still where my private land hunting costs me, and this is including turkey hunting, you know, and gift cards and beer and bacon and whatever else, an occasional pheasant, you know, a couple hundred dollars a year. And that's, I don't mind, you know, as I get older, the idea of paying for hunting doesn't bother me as much, but paying a lot for hunting does. And we're pricing enough people out of hunting as it is. So I am lucky that way. I still live where if you make the effort and you're nice to people, consider it, you can still hunt.
That's not a given, but it's certainly appreciated when and where you can find it. That's for sure. Going back to the Iowa game bird specialist biologist, I'm like on the but the consecutive snow cover, just connect the dots for me there. Is that just with snow cover, food sources getting covered up, pheasants having harder access to it? What's going on there, to the best of your understanding.
If they have to go a long way from shell, you know, pheasants hardly ever starve to death in Iowa. There's food everywhere, unless it gets really, really snowy. And they're hardy and they can dig. But if the, when they have to start going a long way from good winter cover to food, that's when you start having a lot of mortality.
More susceptible to predation and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, predation, exposure, all kinds of things. So that is part of it. And wet springs are bad, too. We have, and then I know in other parts of the pheasant range, people worry about drought. And here, it's never too dry for pheasants here, but it can be. It can be too dry for our cover to be very good, but it's never too dry for the birds. But it can easily be too wet in the spring. And then the chicks get chilled in that first, when they're very young, that's hard on them too. So really, long cold winters and wet springs are what's bad for our birds. That and just pretty relentless habitat loss. It gets worse every year that way.
You've got short hairs, correct?
I have a short hair. I had two up until, I must say, recently. A couple of years ago. But yeah, I have one now. He is six.
6 years old. So he's right in the prime.
I keep trying to tell him.
Have you always had short hairs or have you had other dogs?
I had a setter, was my one non-short hair. And I like that. First of all, I like the pointy breeds. Not that you can't shoot birds over Flushing dogs and Labs and things, but it's just, to me, it's the aesthetics of it, the excitement of walking up on a point is so much a part of what I love about bird hunting that I have pointy dogs. I'm not going to say they're better than Flushing dogs, although I think they are, but it's just more fun.
You've landed as far as what you're looking to do. No, your buddy Rick's got a Springer, right?
He does, and he is, and his Springer is a good retriever. He values that, and I do too. But I just like. My dad had Springers for a while, but I just like walking up on a point. It's just so exciting. And then with pheasants, the thing that's even better than there's been a lot of things about pheasants that are better than grouse, but what is better is that you walk up on the point and you're wondering, is it going to be a rooster and a hen or a hen? And so there's that second surprise. First, you hear the flush, and then there's a second one you wonder, can I shoot this bird? Is this a rooster? And then it is, and it's just a little, it's like you open up a present and there it is. So I love that about it too.
Fortunately, you have typically, and we'll talk about this when we get into shotguns and shooting, but you have a little bit more time to sort of make that assessment. That's probably not a bad thing, right? Based on some of your comments about shooting pheasants, I'm the rough grouse hunter that goes to the open country and I shoot too fast and I can't stop myself.
When they flush that close, you have a lot of time. That is true. Doesn't mean you always hit them, but you do have a lot of time.
So pointing dog, pheasant hunter, you commented earlier a little bit about kind of what you're looking, cornfield with a brushy draw, kind of an ideal setup. How do you like to, if you're in something like that, how do you like to work it? Are you just kind of going for a stroll, letting your dog run? Obviously a 6-year-old dog, he's been around the block. He's seen a thing or two. What's your approach?
Like that in the wind, obviously that's really important. I'm pretty simple-minded when it comes to hunting almost everything. And to me, if you put a dog near cover and food, you're going to find birds. You should put the wind in that dog's face so it has more of an advantage in finding the birds, you'll find more birds there too. I'm not as afraid to hunt Zeke with the wind at his back just because he's pretty experienced by now, but if I can run him in the wind, I always will. When you hunt, in the bigger grass fields, yeah, and you always have to imagine that you're pushing pheasants in front of you. So if you can push them into a corner, into the end of a strip. There was a one of the first birds I shot this year. I was hunting a farm that had some terraces that are in set aside and some nice, really nice cover. And I put Zeke into the bottom of it, you know, going into the wind, and he was going slowly enough that I realized he was probably after birds. And I was able to run around to the other end of it so that essentially I was blocking for him. And as he got to the end, he went on point and two roosters flushed, and I decided just to shoot one of them. And that worked out very well. But that is, you know, blocking like that can be very effective. Or pushing birds into something where they have someplace where they have to fly can be very effective, you know, to an edge, to a corner, anything like that, where they feel like they have to either sit or flush. That's when you get them pointed a lot of the time.
You know, one of the things I feel like I hear a lot about, especially if somebody is comparing like pheasants to grouse or something, is just how much pheasants run, you know, and as that relates to pointing dogs. And I mean, it seems every bird is going to run and move. Some do it more than others. And good dogs, pointing dogs, flushing dogs, they figure out how to track and handle those birds. I think you hunt a lot by yourself. I wonder, like, do you end up in a lot of times where you're kind of like, you got running birds and there's just like nothing you can do. Like it's hard for the dog to get ahead of them. It's hard for you to get ahead of them. I mean, how do you handle that?
It happens and there's not much I can do about it.
Right.
So
it's just persistence basically.
Yeah. I mean, sooner or later you'll find one that wants to sit. And you know, so in that instance I was talking about, I was able to do something about it, to block for Zeke. But you can try to hunt places where you can push them, say, into a corners are really good. Field corners are good. You know, always take into account that the birds will run, but how you can sometimes push them from lighter cover into heavier cover where they'll sit. There's things you can do, but it does, none of them always work.
I mean, I could probably venture to guess that you're similar. I mean, I don't really have a huge strategy that I'm trying to do on every bird. Is kind of more just paying attention to the dog and the surroundings, and you're observing and you're handling each contact individually and just kind of doing whatever instinctually feels right in the moment.
Instincts mostly belong to the dog, not to me. He's a better hunter than I. And so I'm also in the habit of just turning him loose, which works great until I start to hunt with a group. I went out to Western Iowa this earlier this season where there were a ton of birds, and Zeke had no experience at all in hunting with a line of four or five hunters. And it, you know, I just wound up putting him up because otherwise it was one of those things where I would have to leave the line constantly to go see what my dog was up to, which when I'm by myself is great because he knows where the birds are and he's going to go there. But it doesn't work very well for group cohesion. So, that's another reason I hunt by myself.
How does he handle running birds? Do you think he's good, great, still learning? What's your assessment there? And I'm just kind of more curious about like the variation that you might see from dog to dog handling running pheasants, that sort of.
There was a time when he was younger when he would range and bump birds, and he doesn't bump many anymore. And you're still gonna have your days when all the pheasants want to flush. And is this? It goes back. I remember when my first dog was also short hair. I remember thinking that he was bumping birds and pheasants were flushing wild because of it. And then we were hunting along a field edge, and Sam came, as pointing dogs will do, came out of the grass into the stubble where it's easier for him to run, and was just creeping along. And I could see pheasants flushing like 100 yards in front of us. And I realized that it has nothing to do with the dog, that the birds were just going, you know, he wasn't bumping them. He was tiptoeing along and they were just going, and they will. And that's, you just have to hope there's enough that they're going to sit and get shot at.
Now, does he essentially sort of move, relocate, track birds just kind of on his own, and you're just sticking with him?
He will relocate. A lot of times he'll hold a point, and this is maybe not a great habit, but it's how it we do it. You know, he will hold a point until I come up and start kicking around in the grass. And once I'm kicking around in the grass, he starts looking for the bird again. And that's, you know, I've had other dogs I've trained to go when I tap their head or whatever, but Zeke, you know, he only has to, he's just, he will hold the point until I'm there. And then if the bird's moved on, then I start, you know, I've thrashed around enough that he thinks the bird's gone, he'll go.
Yeah. It's funny how, I mean, they obviously pay so much attention and they learn a lot. If you hunt them a lot, they get a lot of experience. I swear my dogs, they, like when I have a, it's a lot of times it's a woodcock, and you know, they tend to hold really tight. And sometimes, you know, my dogs are very good about, they'll go on point wherever, and they wait for me to get into the area. And when I walk in and I'm like within, I don't know, 10 yards, and like, there's not a grouse there, the grouse is typically going to flush. Not always the case, obviously, but if that there's a woodcock there, I feel like my dogs, they'll start kind of moving around, and it feels like they're just trying to help me flush it. Like, it's right here. It just flush it. And it's just, I just have to laugh really at that point. But again, you're in the area and you're, it's within shooting range. So I'm kind of.
Now, my previous dog, Jed, he would just lock up and stay locked up. You could stomp all around in front of him and he wouldn't budge. Which is more the way they're supposed to do it, but you know, this works too.
Okay, so we're midway point. We're gonna kind of transition a little bit, talk shotguns and
sure
shot shells and that sort of thing. But I do want to, before we totally wrap this up, just from here on out, you know, we're midway through your pheasant season. You're going to be focusing on it, obviously, kind of when you can get out. What anything different that you're looking for, going to do differently as far as spots, habitat, with maybe a little bit of snow on the ground, late season conditions, like kind of what does the next month and a half look like for you?
You know, it depends on the weather. Snow, I'm not as big a fan of snow as a lot of people are, because once pheasants learn they can get up on top of it and run around, they can see you coming pretty well in the snow. And it's cold weather is what I prefer. You know, snow I can take or leave alone. Cold weather I like. That makes them go to heavy cover and makes them behave a little better. When it's warm out, especially after they've been hunted some, they realize that all they really have to do every day is stay out of our way. And they'll go out and sit in little spots in cornfields and wherever, you know, little scraps of cover. And it gets cold, they'll get back into the thermal cover because they are smart enough to know that where I might shoot one of them, cold was going to kill all of them. So they, that's what I'm going to hope for, some seasonal temperatures that will keep birds a little more honest and a little more concentrated.
Yep. Concentration, that's going to help any bird hunt. Okay. Well, like I teased there, we'll transition a little bit and talk shotguns. I enjoyed your article in Shooting Sportsman, one of my favorite magazines, and kind of gave a little rundown of the things that you consider when you're thinking about pheasant guns specifically. So the article is kind of broken out in a way that I think we'll sort of go through that list and kind of get some of your thoughts and insights. But starting with probably the most common thing that comes up a lot of times when people are asking about a gun for a specific bird species is what gauge, which is it's a whole rabbit hole. But how do you approach the gauge conversation when it comes to pheasant guns?
Until this year, I've been shooting 20. I've been a 12 gauge shooter most of my life. Took a detour into 20 gauges for 4 or 5 years. This year, although I'm not shooting particularly heavy loads out of it, I'm back to a 12 gauge just because I have I kind of pick a gun each year. I have a lot of guns, but more guns than you can only shoot one gun at once. And so, you know, this year I've got a 12 gauge that I'm shooting and shooting relatively light loads in it, but still a 12 gauge. So honestly, there's not a lot of difference among 12 and 16 and 20 for the kind of hunting I do. And I have to qualify that because I have, as you do, where you live, the huge advantage that I live here. if I don't want to shoot a bird, I can shoot it tomorrow. You know, I'm not, this is, if I was taking my once a year, 3 or 4 day trip to pheasant country, I would bring my Benelli Montefeltro and kill pheasants with it, you know, period. And I'd be ready to take longer shots and I would be gunned for it and practice for it. And but I don't. I can, you know, I'll hunt a lot of days this year. And I don't really care that much anymore if I kill them or not. I mean, I still like shooting birds. I like eating birds. I had leftover roast pheasant for lunch and it was delicious. It's not going to be my last of those this year. But I don't get, you know, I'll shoot. There's just the two of us at home. I'll shoot enough birds. And so that is a totally different mindset than someone else is going to have planning a trip. So, yeah, if 12 gauges are better, I'm sorry. I just say that. Pheasants are big, tough birds. I have shot birds that, you know, a few years ago, I think I mentioned that story. My friend had, Rick had shot a bird and I saw it go off, you know, legs hanging and, hit pretty hard. And a few weeks later, I shot a bird in that same spot and its leg bones had knit and not just knit, it hadn't knit end to end, but it knit just like side to side, like overlapping. So there's one leg was quite a bit shorter than the other, but totally healthy bird, could do everything. I always thought that if you broke a wing, a bird was dead, but it would get caught by something. But last year, Zeke pointed a pheasant that, it could almost fly, and it had, its wingtip had been, someone had shot it and, you know, and broken the end of the wing. Tip of the wing sometime earlier in the season, and that bird was not that, you know, not that many days away from being able to fly again. So they're tough, and if you don't break a wing when you hit that, you know, last pheasant I shot it solidly over a point, hit it hard, watched it keep flying, and then it piled, you know, because I didn't break a wing, it didn't fall. It went about 100 yards and then crashed when we were able to find it. But they're tough. It takes, and so many of them are shot going away. You need to hit them with enough pellets in the body plus enough to break a wing. That's kind of the recipe for killing pheasants.
Ideally, you get some good body penetration, vital hit, and if you can break a wing just to cut that flight off, even better. Yeah. But yeah, that's the gauge one. It is like you pointed out right away there. I mean, there's every gauge can pretty much shoot an ounce of shot, which is a pretty respectable payload. And obviously you can take that to extremes with heavy payloads or lighter payloads, that sort of thing. And it really comes down to a gun that you're comfortable with, confident with, and you know, choose your shots accordingly, right? That's kind of where the whole 28 gauge and 410 thing is. You know, if you know what you're capable of and you choose those shots accordingly, they can do the job. But to say one of those gauges is more effective than a 12 gauge is kind of silly.
Now, the 28 gauges in particular are having a moment right now, and
they certainly are.
People have always thought they were magic. You know, they're nice guns. I've got one, but I don't shoot pheasants with it.
What about action type? I know you have, this is, again, of course, people have their personal preference, but pumps, semi-autos, double guns, likes, dislikes, things to consider.
That Montefeltro I mentioned, or the gun, I say that, you know, if I shot pheasants for money, that's what I'd shoot. You know, it's light. It holds a lot of shells. I can shoot it really well. It's a neat gun. A nice piece of walnut on it. It's, you know, but I like break action guns as much for the convenience of using them, of being able to pop them open if I want to cross an obstacle, and especially if I've got a dog, which I do. You know, if I've got to do stuff with the dog, I like to be able to open a gun up You know, I don't want to put a loaded gun on the ground that, you know, every year you read about some duck hunter who gets shot by his dog. That's not going to be me. So I like break hash guns for that reason. It's and rarely do I have I killed birds with third shots. I, you know, it's usually for me one or none, and I think I've made a couple follow up second barrel shots this year, but usually it's just that first shot. So I said it's nice to know you have more. But now the third way is you get into a lot of birds, or if you're doing the classic driving and blocking type hunt, yeah, then sure, you want to have a lot of shells in the gun. But for me, following my bird dog and not too concerned about shooting a double, two shots is fine.
I'm kind of like that too. I feel like more and more just like a lot of times I'll just shoot once at a bird. So like I'm looking for a certain kind of opportunity, and when everything's there, it lines up, the dog points the bird and I'm in position, you know, I'll raise it up and I feel good enough about it to shoot. I shoot and kind of expecting that bird to fall, which obviously they don't always do. But a lot of times when I miss, a lot of times I won't even follow up. And there was a time where I kind of be like, why didn't I shoot there? But more and more, I'm just kind of like, oh, okay. I'm, you know, we didn't get him on that shot, but to have the second shot obviously is helpful, especially if you wing one or something, you want to try to follow up and put them down. But
although sometimes it's worse because then you can break, you know, if you hit a bird not very hard, it might live. And you know, if you hit that same bird again and break its wing, it probably won't live and you might not find it. So it cuts both ways. And I think about that a lot because I hate losing birds. And I wish I had you know, that idea of you take a shot. If you miss, you miss. That's pretty good. Right? So I'm going to have to work on that. For myself, it's a good attitude. I'd say I'm trying to. This year, I'm just trying not to take any bad shots. That's my goal, and I'm doing all right with it. But I like that one shot or none.
Yeah, and it's like you said too. That I mean, there's so many things that kind of shape the experience for somebody. Like if you are driving, you know, halfway across the country and taking your one trip of the year, you're going to have different motivations and incentives as far, you know, than the you or I that's going out for the afternoon, and you might be out 2 days from now. It's a little different sort of motivation there. But I wanted to ask, is your Monte Feltro, I don't know a ton about them, are they, I know you did a gun fitting with Del Whitman, like, do they have shim kits and stuff? Like, have you made any adjustments, or you just kind of shoot that thing off the rack?
I shoot it off the rack. There's some of my semi-autos I have shimmed. My target gun and some others. This one, I don't think I've done anything to this one. I can't remember. Honestly, I am, and this happened with Dell. You know, I shoot so many different guns in my line of work that he finds people like, to fit me, he told me I had to stop looking at the target and just look at a spot on the ground and bring the gun up, because otherwise I was too accustomed to, you know, fitting the gun on the fly to myself and so, in order to get me right, he had to take my, you know, take that away from me. And he did that by saying, just look at a spot, you know, on the ground halfway between here and the pattern plate and mount the gun. So I shoot enough guns with right-hand cast that he actually wanted to give me right-hand cast for a minute, but that was too crazy for him. And so he backed off, and the gun, the fitting's great. I mean, that gun shoots exactly where I look. I will add drop to guns. I feel like, you know, one of the things that you have to realize if you're trying to fit yourself or see if your gun fits is that no one cheeks a gun as hard in the field as they do when they're trying to see if a gun fits. And there's ways to, one of the tricks, I remember Bob Brister wrote about this, and I stole this trick from him and I had used it. If you want to, you can take a bed sheet and, you know, mount and shoot at that. And the good thing about that is you can't see really where the point of impact is until you've shot it enough times that a hole forms. And so it prevents you from making adjustments as you go. And if you do that, you know, you can then get a better idea of where the gun is shooting for you. But even still, if you're crunching your head down on the stock every time, you're getting a different lower. You wind up with a gun that shoots high because your head's going to be up above the rear. Your eyes going to be up above the rib when you're shooting in the field.
What the shooting the bed sheet, like what would you be doing there? Checking the pattern, or like what are you?
No, that's a fitting.
Oh, okay.
That's for fitting. You shoot the same sheet over and over, and at first you can't, because it's, I don't know, you can't see the holes.
Right.
And then eventually a ragged hole will form at the center of your point of impact. And then you can take that to your gunsmith and say, this is where I was trying to shoot, and this is where I'm shooting, and let's fix the gun. Or you can get your shim kit out and fiddle with that and make the gun shoot more. It's like with my target guns, I like a gun that shoots pretty flat, and I have certainly shimmed those. I have a Beretta 391 semi-auto that I've shimmed down to shoot very flat, and that works best for me.
That is, it's interesting you brought that up. That's something that I notice myself. I mean, I think it's pretty common, obviously, but to not cheek that gun as hard when you're looking at a bird, right? So you kind of, you have that, you want to sort of be up above the gun. And I notice that a lot, like right after when you shoot at a bird, you kind of have that immediate kind of like post-shot analysis, like, oh, I was, that the stock was on my bicep, or I didn't make a good gun mount, or everything was clean there. But I notice a lot where it's like, boy, that gun was barely on my cheek, but with a good fit gun that, you're in the wheelhouse of more often than not making the shot right. But it's a different gun mount typically than if you're standing behind the counter at a gun shop or at home or something. You kind of get down into that gun a little bit more than you do in the field.
It is. And then the other thing, I just noticed this yesterday hunting ducks and geese in the field, is if you don't really look at the bird, if you shoot in the general direction of the bird, that's what you hit. And I've watched enough, for coaching high school trap shooters, I've watched enough kids not focus on targets to know that usually when you don't look hard at the bird, you shoot high. So there's that too. That's not a fit thing. That's a shooting thing. But the result is the same, which is the pellets go flying over the top of the bird.
Are you... self-assessment, do you feel like, are you pretty good at, in the field, shooting at birds, like looking at the white ring? You mentioned in the article the white ring on the pheasant's neck. Do you think back often and be like, I had a real good visual lock on that bird?
I'm getting better at it.
Okay.
It's one of my goals for this year. And I have been hitting birds in the head better. But I get excited.
Yep.
And often that means I wind up shooting things center mass, which is not good. It kills them. It puts a lot of pellets in them.
Yeah.
Sometimes more than I want. But I have been working on that. In part, with when you don't care as much if you shoot things anymore, you find it. You take a little more. It's kind of nice. Because I find I'm a little more in the moment, a little more relaxed.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I can think about, I want to shoot this bird in the head, or let's look at the head this time, or whatever. And it's more so in waterfowling where you know the shot is coming. But yeah. I've been doing it, but I've been hitting my pheasants in the front end too better this year. So, it's I'm a work in progress. We all are.
Yep.
But that is something I have been trying to do, and I do every year. It's my goal, and this year I'm having a little more success with it.
I don't feel like, I don't know if I'm ever going to get to a point where like, oh yeah, I've got that, where I do it more often than not. But I shoot enough birds, I kill enough birds. Like, I'm not scratching my head like thinking, what am I doing wrong? I'm pretty confident in my gun and my shooting, and when I do the right things, the results tend to be what I'm looking for. But that visual lock, a lot of times I'm just like, man, I really I was kind of fuzzy, you know. I wasn't looking at that grouse's head, or I didn't see his beady little eye, that kind of thing. I don't know how to get that to click for myself.
You know, I was just actually just interviewing a friend of mine who's a level 2 sporting clays instructor about this very thing, and he said it's not so much that you see the eye, if that you're trying to see the eye. If you're making that effort, and this is something that Anthony Matarese Jr., who's one of the very best, preaches as well, is that, you know, yes, you're trying to see the rings on the clay target, but we can't always. But if you're trying, then you're doing the right thing.
I do think a lot of it is, it's just that, like you said, it's that excitement, you know, that kind of, that flush of the bird, the thrill of the point, the anticipation walking in. There's a lot of things working against you as far as, like, you know, unless you are like an Anthony Matarese, you know, that methodical mount shoot, you know, or Andy Duffy comes to mind, another sporting clays shooter. I've interviewed him a few times, and he's got a bunch of stories about that. And
Andy is also a terrific field shot. I was lucky to be his partner in the, I think it was 2007, the Rough Grouse National Hunt. And he put on a show for me and the people I was hunting with. It's funny, he and I still talk about it. It's been this many years later. He and I both still remember almost every shot in that hunt and can replay it. And he'll admit to me, he said he was in his zone those 2 days, that, you know, that was, even for him, was pretty thin air. But and interestingly, he told me, you know, that was right, the National Hunt is right before Sporting Clays Nationals, and he had been practicing for Nationals, and what he does, what his practice for Nationals is skeet shooting. He said he likes the confidence of seeing targets break. And that's, you know, that's what you get in skeet. He said, you go out and practice. A lot of people going to go out and practice the hard shots and the long shots and all that. And I said, for him, what really helps him is to go in there with the right attitude. And that means seeing targets break. And so he shot almost all skeet in preparation for Nationals. I don't know how he did in Nationals, but boy, he did put on a clinic in the grouse woods that year. So
probably not terrible practice either, but yeah, like you said, when you're at that high of a level, obviously everybody has a certain level of proficiency, so it does become, it's like golf, you know, it becomes a mental thing, like who can stay in the game and maintain that confidence. So that makes sense. All right, back to shotguns a little bit. Weight and balance, what do you like in a pheasant gun?
I like a gun that is under, like my current, the gun I've been shooting this year, it's an old, and by old, I mean 30-year-old, sort of 680, Beretta 686 Special, which is a neat gun. And way better fit and finished. Well, you know, like your guns, this gun's got a lot of hand work in it that people don't do anymore. Your guns have hand work in it that people don't do anymore. So I like it for that. It's a little under 7 pounds, I think 6 pounds, 14 or something like that, which is easy to carry. It's 12 gauge, which is not outlandish. I don't shoot very well with guns that are really light. I don't understand why, and well, I do understand why people are fixated on light guns, but I wish they, you know, I think they'd shoot better if they weren't. You know, I am, it doesn't bother me to carry it. I don't feel like, and I don't hunt all day very often, but, you know, my legs get tired a lot faster than my arms get tired. I don't really have any trouble carrying a gun. So, and heavy guns are counterintuitively easier to be fast with than light guns, if fast is something you're interested in, which I'm not. So I like a gun, you know. And you get down much below 6 pounds, 6 1/4, 6 pounds, guns get hard to shoot, I think. Feel great to carry. And I get that. And I know there's people who need that. But, you know, 6 1/4 to 6 3/4 is kind of my sweet spot for a pheasant gun, I guess. And that varies for, I mean, everybody's different.
Right. Physical characteristics. And, but when paired with, you know, loads that you're typically going to be shooting for pheasants to a little bit of gun weight is typically not a bad thing. I don't know if maybe I asked you this the last time you were on. Have you, just given you tend to review a lot of stuff and see, have you shot TSS for upland at all?
I've shot like a bird with TSS for upland, and it was interesting. I remember that it was a close crossing pheasant that I shot and absolutely smoked it. And I thought, gosh, this is going to be a mess. And there's just all these tiny little holes in it. There's like, you know, it really wasn't bad. It shot up nearly as badly as I thought it would be because this shot is so small. Yeah, I guess. But no, because that was one of those ones that I did not look at the head, and I center punched it, and I, at like 15, 20 yards, I thought, oh, geez, I shouldn't have done that. And it was fine. So, and it certainly killed the bird right away. I shot a few more birds than just that one. I'm sick of it. But it is, you know, and if you wanted a bird, you know, for taxidermy purposes, absolutely. It leaves just tiny holes. I have been doing a lot of my waterfowl hunting with the steel TSS blended loads, and those I think are really good.
I started to take notice of seeing some of the magazine ads for those.
As long as, you know, if you're going to shoot at long range, you want all of one size shot, I believe. But if you're for like shooting birds over decoys and anchoring the birds that you shoot, that, you know, inside 40 yards, this stuff is phenomenal. And, I've been shooting the Winchester. But yesterday I was shooting Winchester steel BBs and TSS 7s.
Is there, imagine maybe you've spoken to some of the ammunition. I know when I was looking at that, I just wondered, and I have no idea, but I wondered, is there like enough difference as far as like the timing of when the TSS pellets arrive versus the steel pellets, or do they have that all kind of ironed out, like you said, within 40 yards?
You know, in theory, the old theory, you know, they tried to match ballistics, and so that everything would arrive more or less the same time. I think at some point they're different. They will spread out and string. Shot stringing, I'm getting myself in trouble here, is a topic which people spend way too much time thinking about, especially in upland bird hunting. How many 40 degree, 90 degree, 40 yard crossers do you take in a season? Probably you can't even see that far. A lot of the time, a lot of times you're in the woods you hunt, 40 yards is like, may as well be 400 yards. And so that's where, you know, velocity gives you an edge there. Short shot strings give you an edge there, but that is not the shots we're taking. We're taking quartering shots, usually, or short crossers. Now, it gets different if you're hunting a big, long line of, you know, 10 of you out hunting pheasants in the Dakotas, and there's birds getting up and going all directions. Yes, then you may absolutely shoot a long crosser. And then shot stringing might be a concern. And I will get myself in further trouble and say that most people can't shoot effectively far enough that the shot string's going to get them in trouble. I mean, a 40-yard crosser for a lot of people that's a long shot for me. I mean, I practice them, but I don't like to take them. And I try not to anymore, but you get out there, those long crossing shots where shot stringing out, a lot of us are missing anyway. I would say if you wanted to shoot blended loads like that at a, I can't imagine you wouldn't really need to shoot one at a grouse or a woodcock, but you could. And I don't think the shot string would be a factor at all. And certainly not much of a factor in the kind of waterfowl shooting that I like to do.
My thinking on the shot string has been heavily influenced by what I've read, but also our mutual friend Dale Whitman, and he knows what I do, and that's really his you know, the ranges that I'm shooting grouse and woodcock, I mean, it's essentially irrelevant for what I'm doing. But the blended material types is interesting to think about, if nothing else.
It is, and it seems to work. I'm not sure so much about the ones that combine like two different types of lead or steel. Those are gimmicks, and they work. You know, both can be true at once. And I've had some really good success with some of those, more again in waterfowl hunting than in upland hunting. But it's when you start blending the two different shot materials that those shells actually do work.
And in asking you about TSS for upland, it's a lead free option, right? It's a non toxic option, so that's where it could become a consideration for some folks. But it's the kinds of shooting that upland hunters typically do, you know, it's somewhat cost prohibitive. I mean, you pay such a premium for TSS shells. I do know some people that have done it, talking to customers, people do it. So that's why I was asking you if you had any experience with it for upland.
But you have some well-heeled customers. Indeed, this is not, you know, it's not me. What's encouraging is I got some of Boss's new copper ammunition, and I've shot exactly one pheasant with it, and it fell pretty dead, which is, you know, too small a sample size to say anything, but I'll be shooting more of that. And that has the not as dead, it's between bismuth and steel in density.
Between bismuth and steel. Okay, so less dense than lead, less dense than bismuth, but more dense than steel. Okay.
Well, it's harder than bismuth, so you do not suffer the effects of bismuth shot.
They don't fragment.
Shattering. Okay. Yeah, don't fragment either in the bird or coming out of the gun, so that your patterns are going to be about, from what I've seen, what little work I've done with it so far, it patterns, you know, about like unbuffered bismuth, which is, say, not quite as well as lead, but fine, again, for our purposes. And the really good thing, besides that it's relatively, I think it's like $2 a shell, I think, you know, the Boss direct to customer model, it's about $2 per shell, and it is, well, harder than bismuth, safe in older guns. So this is now an affordable pellet that we can shoot in our old Parkers and Foxes and things.
I think I listened to a podcast when Boss was kind of announcing that's the way they were going. And I hadn't thought much about it since. I didn't really buy, I don't think I bought any ammo this year. I just had kind of had everything I needed. But what is the bismuth pricing at right now? Do you know?
I know that the price of raw bismuth, from what I understand, is like gone up about six times and the sixfold. Which is a lot. I also know that when I spoke to some ammunition makers at Pheasant Fest back in March, that they had bought up enough bismuth that they had enough on hand for a while. So I think, you know, like looking at the prices there, they haven't gone up much yet, but I'm not sure how long that's going to last. So. I think, you know, that we have a potential alternative is great. Not going to help my wife's teeth as much as the bismuth, which does, you know, shatters sometimes in the barrel, shatters in the bird, and breaks under your teeth, which is what I love about it. But it's exciting to have an alternative. And yeah, bismuth, I also don't fully understand, but I think bismuth was artificially low for a while due to some kind of manipulation by the Chinese government, and now it's up high and may not be coming down again. So, which is too bad, but it's a good product.
Definitely filled a space in the being safer vintage guns and non-toxic and all those sort of things. So to have less options is not as ideal for us double gun enthusiasts.
But now we seem to have copper, so let's hope that does well.
How about chokes?
I shoot like improved cylinder, improved modified most of the time in my guns. I am not a
choke changing son of a gun, as a former colleague of mine used to say.
I am not. I am like set them and forget them.
Yeah.
I have also stood in front of the gun cabinet paralyzed, as we all have. Pondering, you know, ten thousandths of an inch. Gosh, do I do this? Do I do that? But most of the time in my bird guns, it's improved cylinder, improved modified, unless it's, you know, I do have an old superposed that's skeet and skeet. That's what I shoot. That's what I'm shooting that day. But, and that works. It's a little more open. I like the confidence of knowing I have a tight second barrel if I miss or hit a bird. I don't know if it helps any, but it makes me feel better about that second shot. And I hope psychologically keeps me from just throwing it right after the first one. That may or may not be true, but that's my story. And improved cylinder, I guess. Yeah, you know, I could be as happy probably shooting a skeet choke for the shots I take, but I don't, like so many people, I want to make sure I've got enough density, and I labor under the delusion that I can shoot, which sometimes I can and sometimes I can't. But so that makes me less concerned about, you know, a couple inches of pattern spread here or there, and more concerned about trying to get my mechanics right and look at the bird and mount the gun right and all those things instead.
Yeah, I have found that if you're going to be doing the same thing that you've done before with success, that there's some benefit to kind of keeping things the same, if nothing else, but to remove the mental strain that you might put on yourself.
Yes, mental strain. Exactly.
One other thing that's not shotgun related that I want to ask you about, but anything new? I mean, we touched a little bit on ammo and stuff. I don't know if you did a big collective gun review package for anybody this year, but anything new on the market as far as makes, models, anything catch your interest, real intriguing for the upland hunter, pheasant hunter this year?
The most interesting gun I've seen, and it is hideous. In fact, I'm buying one, is the Beretta AX800, which is a waterfowl gun, which is entirely polymer receiver. No metal in it at all. No, and it's has various advantages that they have learned making entirely polymer receivers for military guns at Beretta, but that is a new thing. And the Upland guns, whatever you're coming out with next, probably is of interest to me. Those are the two that I can think of right off the top of my head.
I'm looking at the AX800. That is a very futuristic looking shotgun.
It is that. It happens to fit me just about perfectly and shoot exactly where I look, and I really like it. I feel the same way about ducks and geese that I do about upland birds, which is that they prefer to be shot with walnut stocked guns. In fact, there, you know, I was just in the Denver Museum of Natural History. I'm going to get the quote wrong, but there's a Inuit exhibit, and there's a quote from a woman who makes these, you know, really beautiful hunting clothes, and says something like, "The animals we hunt prefer to be killed by beautiful things." So it's not just me who thinks that. But sometimes this is not possible. Sometimes you need to hunt in some rocky, muddy place for a steel place with steel pit blind frames or whatever, and then you want a plastic gun. And I like that gun a lot. So there's that one. You know, I probably am getting ready to buy my next 7th or 8th or 9th or whatever it will be, Red Label, if there's a new one out, and, you know, see if I can either keep it or not. So that is interesting to me. I'm trying to think if there's other things that I'm aware of, and there are, and I know there are, and I can't think of what they are right now because I'm not prepared.
I threw that one at you out of the blue. That does remind, maybe you'll think of something else, but that reminds me, you're also a Ruger Gold Label guy, which do you, I'm certainly talked about that at one point, and I always remember the interview that you did with Reed Bryant, you and our buddy Rayhan talking about the Ruger Gold Labels, which is a side-by-side. You still have, do you have one of those, couple of those?
No, one.
Okay. Okay. Does that see action every year?
Last year it did.
Okay.
You know, I find that I tend to shoot over-unders better. That gun is one that I shoot reasonably well. I shot it when I hunted with a lot. I shot it pretty well. And yes, it does. It does get out. Last year, they got out, had it out at the end of the season. and it is. It's, you know, I think it's probably tripled in value. So I got a really good deal on it because I bought it at the writer price from Ruger, which was quite generous. And since then, it's like tripled in, you know, worth three times, four times what I paid for it. But it's also, you know, it's just a gun and made to be hunted with, so I take it.
But did, yeah, did they only make those in 12 gauge?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought.
But it's a 6.5 pound 12 gauge.
Right.
So
right.
Like,
yeah. It's like a why round action, kind of based on the round action, right? Though.
And that's the thing. You know, I my dream gun would be like a, you know, McNaughton or something like that.
Yeah.
A real Scottish round action gun, because I think those are the most beautiful hunting guns made.
They're pretty spectacular. Yeah.
This is not that pretty, but it is the same. And yeah, the action on this thing is tiny. I mean, the barrel, the 12 gauge barrels do look just like they're, like they've been put on a 28 gauge frame on that gun. It's a tiny little frame. And so this is the closest I will ever get to owning a McNaughton, probably. And so I like it.
Yeah.
I would love to see,
I don't think I've ever seen one of those, held one in person. I would love to get my hands on one. So I'll have to try to do that at some point.
We can do that.
Yeah.
I don't see any reason why there couldn't be an Upland Gun Company round action.
Our Venus is close. Like we wouldn't call it a round action, but it's set up a little differently than like your classic Anson and Dealey box lock, and it is a very, very small frame to that point. So it's close.
It is dainty. This is ridiculous. I've never looked inside. I don't know how all the parts fit in there because it's so small, but yeah. It is a true round action, and I like it for that.
All right. Before we wrap up, pheasant, you mentioned roast pheasant for lunch. What do you have any other preferred methods for preparation on pheasant?
Well,
they do taste darn good. I will say that
they do, and they are best. What I forget every year is that a fresh pheasant is way better than a frozen pheasant. So if I've been shooting young birds mostly this year for whatever reason, and so I will get them home and pluck them right away and roast it fresh, and that is wonderful. Sometimes this is not possible, and you have to eat pheasant a different way. And what I found, and I never tried it before, is pheasant Parmesan, for whatever reason, is ridiculously easy, and I will bone the thighs and I'll take the breast, and some birds, especially if they've been shot or whatever, they're an older bird, pound them a little bit and dip them in egg and Italian breadcrumbs and fry that. And then, you know, put marinara sauce and mozzarella on it and throw it into the broiler till the cheese melts. And it is more than the sum of its parts. Which a lot of these things aren't. This one is. It is like, it's remarkable how good it is. So, and my wife, who's Italian, loves it. So that's become a staple in the rotation too.
Pheasant parm, I love it. That is something I have considered making that with grouse. I have not tried it yet though, and I've never really heard of anybody trying that.
Grouse are so, it'd probably work with a grouse, and grouse is such wonderful, tender, sweet meat. This, for whatever reason, just works spectacularly well.
It sounds tasty. I've grilled a lot more grouse this year than I ever have in the past, and I partly influenced because I finally got one of these, you know, digital meat probe thermometers that kind of hooks up to your phone and everything, and gave me the confidence to throw them on the grill. And I mean, it obviously you realize right away just how not long of a time it takes for a bird like that to get up to temperature. And but I've done it and right away just real they're so good. I mean, I just put a different couple of different sort of steak rubs or chicken rubs that there's a couple kinds that I really like and throw them on the grill. And my wife and boys, everybody, they've been a big hit. So we've been grilling a lot of grouse this year.
Glad you have a lot of grouse to grill. That's also good.
The supply has been temporarily shut off. And maybe if we get any more grouse this year, there will not be, the quantity will be low. But I got a few packs left that we'll be probably going through here, but it was good for while it lasted, for sure. I, as always, appreciate you taking the time to join me and the listeners and share some of your insights and knowledge with us. We certainly appreciate it. Where could folks go if they wanted perhaps do a bit more reading and see some of the other things that you've written and published?
I'm on the Field and Stream website a lot, obviously, and in the magazine, which I'm not saying this because I write for it. It's really good. You know, twice a year, it is a great big thick coffee table sized magazine with a lot of good writing in it. The last issue was a dog issue, so that made it better too, but really impressive. So you can find me there. I do the shotgun column for Ducks Unlimited. I've been writing more things for Shooting Sportsman as well. So you can find me. And there's a whole bunch of videos and things I did for DU and stuff online too. So there's no shortage of me out there if people really want to find me.
We appreciate it. You keep up the good work, my friend, and I'll do my best to grab some links and throw some stuff in the show notes as well. But do you have any hunting trips left, or are you just going to be kind of taking advantage of what's right on your home turf for the rest of the season?
I think for that is totally planned. No, I did Saskatchewan in late October. It was great. And then a short trip to Western Iowa for pheasants and hoping to think of something for, you know, after we close down here, but there's nothing definite yet. So otherwise we go until January 10th, then there's a week of goose hunting after that. And usually, although right now I wish there was more hunting to do, usually by the time I'm done, I'm ready to be done. So I think it'll just pheasants at home. Got some catching up to do there. I have not been as much as usual, so I'll be making up for that in the second half of the season.
Excellent. Well, you and Zeke, enjoy your time afield. And like I said, keep up the great work. We appreciate your time as always, Phil. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hang with me for just a second, Phil. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.